Oh, I was Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, Lieutenant General Stephen Townsend, acknowledged Tuesday the U.S. military may have played a role in an airstrike in the contested city Mosul March 17 that killed dozens of civilians. But there are reports the blast could have been caused by an Islamic State bomb. The general said civilians may have been gathered together by the city's IS defenders, so the U.S. could be blamed for their deaths or to use them as human shields.
The coalition respects human life, which is why we will not abandon our partners in their time of need or because of ISIS's inhumane tactics of terrorizing civilians, using human shields, and fighting from protected sites such as schools, hospitals, religious sites, and civilian neighborhoods.
Townsend said U.S. personnel are inspecting the site to gather further information. U.N. Human Rights Office spokesman Rupert Colville said exposing civilians to possible harm is a tactic used by Islamic State or ISIL.
The High Commissioner is welcoming the announcement by the Iraqi security forces and the international coalition that they are conducting investigations into some of the most serious incidents resulting in loss of civilian lives.
The U.N. said more than 300 have been killed in Mosul between February 17 and March 23. Villagers in the Democratic Republic of Congo discovered the remains of two UN investigators who disappeared earlier this month while monitoring a sanctions regime in Kasai Central Province. Three bodies, two Caucasian, one Congolese, were found near where the UN investigators were last seen. The remains of the two UN officials are likely those of Michael Sharp of the U.S. and Zeta Catalan of Sweden. The area is at the center of an insurgency. The UN pledged to launch an inquiry with the aim of bringing those responsible to justice. This is VOA News. British Prime Minister Theresa May will file formal divorce papers Wednesday with the European Union, triggering a two-year process of separation that, according to Monash University European Union analyst Ben Wellings, will usher in a period of uncertainty on the future of the world's fifth biggest economy and that of the EU itself.
The stakes are high in this high-risk gamble. You know, high risks means high dividend. It could all be pulled off by the United Kingdom government with the Conservative Party behind it. But it could also go badly, and Britain could lose its position in terms of its economy. It could lose its position in terms of its global influence.
The invoking of the Lisbon Treaty's Article 50 comes 9 months after British voters elected to leave the EU in a referendum. Meanwhile, the Scottish Parliament voted Tuesday to seek a new independence referendum from Britain over Brexit, although London rejected the second referendum bid. The Islamic State reportedly has launched a counterattack in northern Syria to fend off a U.S.-backed rebel drive on the de facto IS capital of Raqqa. The Kurdish and Arab militia units of the Syrian Democratic Forces are battling over the town of Takba and its strategic dam over the Euphrates River. It seized an airbase nearby on Sunday. Meanwhile, Syrian engineers are trying to open spillways and ease pressure on the dam. The government said U.S. airstrikes have damaged the dam and that it could collapse. President Donald Trump Tuesday declared an end to what he called the war on coal with the signing of another executive order that eliminates restrictions on fossil fuel production imposed by the previous Obama administration.
With today's executive action, I am taking historic steps to lift the restrictions on American energy, to reverse government intrusion, and to cancel job-killing regulations.
Mr. Trump said the order will help ignite a new energy revolution. Environmentalists and some lawmakers denounced the move as ignoring the effects of climate change. French police said they've opened an inquiry after a Chinese man was shot dead by police in his Paris home, triggering riots by members of the Chinese community. The shooting occurred Sunday night, leading China's foreign ministry to call in a French diplomat. It brought dozens of the French-Chinese community onto the streets of Chinatown district of Paris.
We don't know the details for it, but we just know he lost his life. So we just came here and we want to ask to police. We want to know the situation. We want to know the details.
Media reports indicate the killing took place in front of the 56-year-old victim's family after police were called in to investigate a dispute with a neighbor. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani signed bilateral agreements with his Russian counterpart Tuesday during a visit to Moscow. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Wednesday, March 29th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. DRC's political agreement is in danger of collapsing after mediators walked out.
The party secretary general, Jean-Marc Kabund, told reporters that there can no longer be any doubt about the real intentions of Joseph Kabila and his political family to not move towards elections.
That's viewers William Klaus in Kinshasa. Cameroon has been gripped by a second teacher's strike. Sudan opens a new corridor to deliver aid to South Sudan refugees. A Nigerian American is working to correct diet-related disorders among Africans in the U.S. diaspora. And Zambia's main opposition criticizes the government for launching a national consultation to stay or withdraw from the International Criminal Court.
We're surprised that a country that is trying to become a democratic country, we now are faced with a situation where we want to follow some other dictators in Africa who want to pull out of the ICC.
Charles Kakoma is a spokesman for Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development. And we have a report on the death of South African anti-apartheid icon, Achmed Kathrada. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, a political deal signed on New Year's Eve that is supposed to clear the way to elections and the departure of President Joseph Kabila could be on the brink of collapse. William Klaus has the latest from the Congolese capital, Kinshasa.
Congo's oldest and largest opposition party, the UDPS, held a news conference on Tuesday afternoon. The party secretary general, Jean-Marc Kabund, told reporters that there can no longer be any doubt about the real intentions of Joseph Kabila and his political family to not move towards elections. He accused the president and his allies of deliberately undermining the agreement they signed on December 31st with the Rassemblement, a large opposition coalition in which the UDPS is the leading member.
J'appelle le peuple congolais à rester vigilant.
Kabund called on the Congolese to prepare themselves for a large march on April 10th to protest the non-application of the accord and Kabila's plans for a lifelong presidency. Hundreds of angry UDPS supporters gathered in the road outside, shouting that Kabila must step down or be chased from the country. They fired live rounds in the air while the crowd hurled stones. Kabila's second, and according to the constitution, final term, expired on December 19th, but elections to find his successor were postponed and the president has remained in office. The New Year's Eve deal, which was mediated by the Congolese Catholic Church, known as CENCO, offered a peaceful solution. A transitional government, headed by a prime minister from the Rassemblement, was supposed to take over and lead the country towards elections in late 2017. However, talks about how to implement the accord have faltered, and the two sides are still split on several key issues, most intractably how to nominate the next prime minister. Last week, CENCO told the Rassemblement and Kabila's political alliance to resolve their differences and sign an implementation agreement before March 27th. That ultimatum went unmet, and on Monday night, CENCO's president, Monseigneur Marcel Outembi, announced the bishops were ending their mediation.
La CENCO lance un appel.
Outembi appealed to the negotiators to not lose sight of the main objective of the talks, the organisation of elections in less than a year. On Tuesday afternoon, the bishops met with President Kabila, and one told VOA that Kabila had undertaken to unblock the stalemate. On Tuesday night, the presidency issued a statement, saying that the current impasse must not mean the definitive rupture of the dialogue. For the UDPS, however, there is no longer any hope of a resolution. Political protests have been banned in much of Congo since September 2016, and the UDPS's announcement of one on April 10th will renew fears of violent repression by the state. William Klaus for VOA News, Kinshasa.
Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development, the UPND, says it is shocked by President Edgar Lungu's call for a national consultation on whether to remain or withdraw from the International Criminal Court, the ICC. At its January 2017 summit in Addis Ababa, the African Union encouraged member states to consider leaving the ICC, which it criticized for unfairly targeting Africans. President Lungu says the choice to stay or withdraw from the ICC should be a democratic one made by Zambians. He says he is saddened that some Zambians were politicizing the consultation. UPND spokesman Charles Kakoma says Zambia should not follow the path of countries with dictatorial leaders who have reasons to fear the ICC. He also says Zambia is currently experiencing economic hardships and has no money to spend on a national consultation about the ICC.
So far, Zambians do not have any issue, any problem with the ICC. We have been good members of the ICC. And so we are shocked to hear that we needed to decide our membership of the ICC. We are also surprised that at a time when the country is going through economic hardships, at a time when the government is failing to provide even bursaries or loans to students at our universities because the government claims they have no money, and at a time when the government is going to the International Monetary Fund for a bailout, we now have a consultation process that is going to cost millions and millions of Zambian money to do those consultations. Secondly, we're surprised that a country that is trying to become a democratic country, we now are faced with a situation where we want to follow some other dictators in Africa who want to pull out of the ICC because they fear that they can be indicted. And we have many countries in Africa now that want to pull out of the ICC because they have committed atrocities, they are violating human rights, and this is the trend that we are seeing in Zambia.
That's correct, but don't you think that the consultation is in line with the view among African Union members about the ICC being anti-Africa?
No, the ICC is not anti-Africa. It is anti-dictators and anti-abusers of human rights. And therefore, if by coincidence we are seeing many African leaders being indicted, it's just that they are failing to uphold human rights in Africa, failing to uphold democracy. And there are so many atrocities, so many people being killed at the hands of the state. And that's how they find themselves at the ICC. And for us in Zambia, the majority of the people think that the best way to protect our democracy and the best way to stop leaders from abusing human rights and committing these killings and other atrocities is for us to remain in the ICC so that it acts as a buffer zone. And it is frightening that our leaders are thinking that we should pull out of the ICC so that whenever they commit human rights abuses, they should go scot-free.
Did the government say why it has launched this consultation on the ICC? Did the government explain to the people?
We just hear that the government of Zambia needs to take a position on this issue. Well, everybody is suspicious because there's no convincing reason coming from the government why we should pull out of the ICC.
Let me go back to what I wanted to ask you also. The government has directed that private and public schools begin to sing the national anthem and also to display the portrait of the president in schools. The Minister of Information and Broadcasting, Kapemba Mulenga, says that this will foster a spirit of unity and patriotism.
Yes, of course. That was the original idea, to have a national anthem and all these national symbols meant to foster unity. But perhaps the question that should be asked to the Minister of Information is, what research has been done to find out that the pupils in schools are not singing the national anthem, and what are the results? Because if you went around asking, probably she could be challenged, and those allegations are not credible.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesman for Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lusaka. Today's Wednesday, March 29th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. Cameroon's education was rocked by more turmoil on Tuesday when teachers in the country's 8 French-speaking regions decided to join their colleagues who are on strike in the country's 2 English-speaking regions. As Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports for VOA from Yaoundé, the Francophone teachers say they are owed salary from as far back as 7 years.
No pay, no school. Hundreds of teachers from Cameroon's secondary and high schools demonstrated Tuesday outside the Ministry of Finance in Yaoundé. Among them is 27-year-old Rogers Kiven, who traveled to the capital from Mokolo on Cameroon's border with Nigeria. He says he began teaching 4 years ago, but has not been paid.
We discovered that 2 years, 3 years, 4 years after that, we still have not had a franc. We communicated our minister, and he communicated with his colleague from finance. From those communications, we were able to deduce that our monies were with the Minister of Finance. Inasmuch as we are not paid, we are not going to leave this place.
Officials met with teacher representatives late Monday. The teachers refused a request to stop their strike while the government examines the issue. Ministry of Secondary Education Human Resources Director Moussa Jafaru spoke during that meeting.
Le dossier dont je viens de vous parler, c'est 11,648 dossiers. On aurait quand même.
He says the Ministry of Secondary Education has forwarded to the Ministry of Finance more than 11,000 authenticated files from teachers who have to be paid. He says he understands that it may be difficult to raise the money and pay them at once, but that there should be transparency, traceability, and rationality in what is done. An official at the Ministry of Finance did not respond to a request from VOA for an interview. Cameroon has around 80,000 secondary school and high school teachers. Those claiming salary arrears are primarily recent graduates, about 20,000 of them, according to the association that organized the strike. Each year in Cameroon, the state recruits about 2,000 teacher training graduates, but they say their monthly wages come late or not at all. 30-year-old teacher Zudom Calvin from Eastern Cameroon blames administrative bottlenecks.
They ask us to compile documents, and even when we compile those documents, sometimes they get lost. So we don't want their system to go on like that. He must pay us.
The teachers say they are in debt and struggling to take care of their families. This new strike leaves many classrooms empty at schools around the country. Schools remained closed in Cameroon's 2 English-speaking regions, the Northwest and the Southwest, as a separate teacher strike enters its 5th month. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The East African Community Secretary General, Libera Nfumukeko, has snubbed a report presented by Jamal Benema, Special Advisor to the UN Secretary General on Burundi. The comments come after EAC and ECGLR are for the first time working together to bring stability in the region. Moses Aviarimana reports from Burundi's capital, Bujumbura.
Jamal Ben Omar, the Special Advisor to the United Nations Secretary General, had earlier this month presented a report to the United Nations Security Council on the current political situation in Burundi. He expressed concerns over worsening human rights situation in the country. Libera Fumukeko, the East African Community Secretary General, snubbed the report and that it doesn't represent East Africa's position.
You said that Jamal Ben Omar, you know, did give a briefing to the Security Council of the United Nations. And these are really his own views. He has an organization in Burundi. He has people who report to him. And this is not the work of the East African community. It's really the work of his team. So we do not really associate to the report that he gave to the Security Council of the United Nations.
The Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights had documented allegations of extrajudicial killings, arbitrary arrests and forced disappearances, as well as cases of torture and ill-treatment. The training is said to have declined in the country. Muita Mobori is the executive secretary of the International Conference for the Great Lakes region.
For us who live here, we continue to preach to the world that we live in a very safe environment. We do not at any one time feel insecure for giving this enabling environment. Of course, there are challenges. There are political challenges, there are economic challenges. But which state in the world doesn't have this sort of challenges?
According to the report by Ben Omar, there had been no significant progress in the dialogue led by the East African community. The United Nations Secretary General Advisor said that the United Nations would continue to support the facilitator of the East African-led dialogue. However, Mr. Mfumukeko said that the joint technical team is yet to be put in place.
And we have actually attempted a few times to really come to a formal agreement. At this stage, we have drafts of the terms of reference, but we don't have any memorandum of understanding finalized. So I would say that legally, what you refer to as being a joint technical team is not there yet.
As there's increased concern of the insecurity in the Great Lakes region, the East African community and the International Conference for the Great Lakes region are in consultations to adapt a framework where the two organizations will cooperate mainly to address the economic and security concerns in the Great Lakes region. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
The Sudanese government says it is opening a new humanitarian corridor this week for the United Nations World Food Programme to deliver food to hungry South Sudanese. The new route begins in Sudan's Kordofan state and crosses into South Sudan's former unity state, where an estimated 100,000 people are facing famine. Nabil Biagio reports from Khartoum.
Ahmed Mohamed Adam, who runs Sudan's Humanitarian Aid Commission, says the new route means aid workers will be able to reach hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese who have nothing to eat.
The government of Sudan has agreed to open up a new route from Al-Obeid, Heglig, Rabokona, Bentiu, so that we can deliver aid to Unity State and Greater Bahar al-Ghazal, where the people most affected by the famine in South Sudan reside.
In 2014, the government of Sudan and South Sudan signed a memorandum of understanding that allows WFP to deliver 65,000 tons of food aid from Sudan's White Nile state to South Sudan. Speaking in Arabic, Adam says, the new route by road will open immediately.
The delivery of food to these areas should start this week. To that effect, the government has donated 10,000 sacks of sorghum, which are now in our storehouses, in Adiba Bed, ready to be transported through the newly established route.
Marta Reuters, the UN resident and humanitarian coordinator in Sudan, says over the last 3 months, the largest number of South Sudanese refugees have crossed into Sudan, fleeing hunger in their country. Reuters says most South Sudanese arriving in Sudan are extremely malnourished and exhausted.
It is of great concern that these people are coming to us in very poor conditions. They are leaving South Sudan in principle because they cannot afford to live there. They do not have enough food. They do not have enough security. It is our hope that we are able to feed these people in South Sudan so that they do not feel the need to come in such great numbers to Sudan.
Sudan is host to more than 350,000 South Sudanese refugees who fled their country since the outbreak of fighting began more than 3 years ago. Reuters says the new route will help aid workers reach people in famine-afflicted areas of South Sudan, which were not possible to reach before. WFP says it will deliver to South Sudan 11,000 metric tons of sorghum in 7 convoys of 30 to 40 trucks this week. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Khartoum.
South African anti-apartheid activist Ahmed Kathrada, who spent 18 years imprisoned alongside Nelson Mandela, has died at the age of 87. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Ahmed Kathrada was a child when he launched what would become a lifelong quest for equal rights in his native South Africa. As a boy of 12, he joined the nation's Young Communist League, which opposed the racist apartheid government. At 17, he was arrested for his resistance to laws that discriminated against South Africans of Indian origin. And in 1964, he and six others stood in the dock alongside anti-apartheid icons Nelson Mandela and Walter Sisulu as a judge handed the group a life sentence for their efforts to disrupt white minority rule. Cotrato would spend the next 26 years in prison, 18 of them alongside Mandela, who became South Africa's first black president in 1994 and was widely regarded as the father of the nation. At Mandela's 2013 funeral, Cotrato tearfully remembered their relationship.
When Walter died, I lost a father. And now I have lost a brother. My life is in a void, and I don't know who to turn to.
Cotrato's death at the age of 87 also feels like a family affair in South Africa. Shortly after his death was announced Tuesday, President Jacob Zuma called for an official funeral and instructed flags to fly at half-staff across the nation for the man he called Uncle Kathy. Nelson Mandela Foundation Chief Executive Sello Hatang said Cotrato was more than just a friend to Mandela, who Hatang referred to by his clan name, Madiba.
Madiba said he surrounded himself with friends who could tell him when he was going wrong, and he considered Mr. K one of those friends who could tell him as he was going wrong.
Mandela kept Cotrato close during his presidency, making him a top political advisor. In his later years, Cotrato continued to be a voice of moral authority and directed some of his ire at Zuma, who has weathered a number of corruption scandals. Last year, in an open letter, he called on Zuma to resign, saying, "Dear Comrade President, don't you think your continued stay as president will only serve to deepen the crisis of confidence in the government of the country?" Hatang also urged South Africans to celebrate Cotrato's life by trying to live up to his principles.
In his honor, may we continue to build the world that's more equal, not just in South Africa, but globally, that the vulnerable in our society are then included more and they are taken care of.
Cotrato will be buried in Johannesburg on Wednesday in accordance with Muslim rites. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
In the U.S. and Africa, communities of African descendants are experiencing a high rate of diet-related disorders like diabetes and heart disease. A Nigerian-American in Washington wants to change that. VOA's June So caught up with Tambra Stevenson at a recent event to promote her initiative.
Tambra Ray Stevenson redefines the kitchen as a healing space.
I am de-stressing as I'm massaging. This is my stress ball, ladies, okay? Me massaging the kale. All that.
Last year, she launched a nonprofit called WANDA, which stands for Women Advancing Nutrition, Dietetics, and Agriculture. Based in Washington and Nigeria, WANDA focuses on developing the next generation of women and girls as leaders in nutrition.
My daughter, who was going to school, and the teacher didn't feel the need to have healthy food in the classroom, and I thought the only way to combat this is to have an army of women who care about creating a healthier generation, and it starts with us as women to take back our communities.
She also sees a huge food challenge. The UN has declared a decade of action on nutrition, and the World Health Organization has estimated 4 million people in Africa will die of non-communicable diseases like diabetes and heart attacks by 2020.
And without any intervention, we will find ourselves in the same crises that we have with AIDS, malaria, and TB.
For producer June So, Mary Alice Salinas, VOA News, Washington.
And that's it for this Wednesday, March 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Hello, I am your host, Shaka Sali. Every Wednesday night, the Voice of America's Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, 20 million people are suffering from a hunger crisis. An in-depth discussion on the international call for action on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.